Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Lynn Curtis, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum and curator of exhibitions. I'm your chair for today's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Mr. Robert Flynn Johnson. Mr. Johnson, curator emeritus, was curator in charge of the Achenbach Foundation for Graphic Arts at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco for 32 years, from 1975 to 2007. He is also an art history instructor and has served on the faculty of the San Francisco Art Institute since 1977 and at the University of California, Santa Cruz since 2009. Robert Johnson is the author of numerous publications, including Lucian Freud, Works on Paper, 1988, Plant Kingdoms, The Photographs of Charles Jones, 1999, Artist Books in the Modern Era, 2001, Anonymous Enigmatic Images by Unknown Photographers in 2004, and The Face in the Lens, Enigmatic Images of People by Unknown Photographers, 2009. I now present to you Robert Flynn Johnson.
Thank you. When I heard that gavel going, I thought we were going to begin the first works in the auction here this evening, but we're not. I first have to say that I apologize in advance to those that might be hearing this on the radio or podcast, because obviously this is a talk tonight about photography, and photography is a visual medium, and so the works of art are kind of denied to you, except for the talk itself. I should say that some, probably about two-thirds, but not all of the works we're seeing this evening are in the last two books I've done, Anonymous and The Face in the Lens, and then there are new photographs that I acquired since those books went to press. So it's a mixture of the two. But the works of art are all anonymous photographs. Somebody asked, how I took them all, and I didn't take any of them. They are works that are works that I found. I own them all. I found them all, and they are works that are all portraits. I did an earlier version of this talk in Bogota, Colombia, in May of 2009. The talk was on portraiture, and of course, lots of other people came and talked about famous photographers in the history of the medium. And I came up with a talk about anonymous photographs. I have a special love of this sort of topic, and I want to go over a few things with you before we start looking through the slides, through the images. When one thinks of portraits, I think one naturally is inclined towards the three Fs: family, friends, and famous. Family and friends are obviously easy to explain. They're your world. Famous are people through notoriety, either in the arts or politics or infamy. One knows their faces, God help us, with the internet and stuff, but they're out there. But what of the rest? Obviously, there are hundreds of millions of photographs in the world. In fact, the late curator at the Museum of Modern Art, John Sarkowski, had that wonderful line years ago when he said, "There's more photographs in the world than there are bricks." And I'm not going to try to disprove him. But what is interesting is what makes a compelling portrait. Obviously, if it's of one's family or friends, one has a natural inclination to love or respect those people, and to have the famous people either, that's kind of a recognition from the world out there, from the news and stuff. But what about the vast majority of other photographs that are portraits? Well, one of the things you've got to realize that I find collecting is a journey, not a destination. And so when I go out looking for these photographs, you know, there's a wonderful line about going to a flea market or an antique fair. And the line is that if you have no expectations, you can't be disappointed. And so it's not like, oh, I'm going to Paris, so I'm going to find an unrecognized Degas drawing or something like that. You know, I have a sense of the curiosity of looking to find, and if it's a bad day and I don't find much or find anything, I've had an interesting experience at least looking. And of course, sometimes one does find things. And I've got nothing against established galleries. You know, people have busy lives, and they go to a gallery which has carefully found artists and has supported those artists and carefully frames the works and puts them on the wall. And it is, it's a marvelous thing, and I buy works from that sort of gallery too. But I love the chance taking of going out there and trying to find these works, the works that we're going to be seeing this evening. It's a little like kind of panning for gold. Most of the pebbles in the stream are just worthless pebbles. But occasionally, in the bottom of your pan, you find this nugget, this fleck of gold that's special. And the same thing with me. I'll look through a box of discarded photographs, and I will occasionally find an absolute treasure. Now, when I say a treasure, I mean a treasure to me. I'm not saying a treasure to the world. These things still aren't very valuable. You know, I once jokingly said, God, with the success of my book, these photographs I bought for $2 are now worth $10. You know, that's one of the things I love about this, is that, number one, any of you in the room here can collect like I do, and any of you can collect like I do, and you would all collect to a great extent. There might be some overlap of images that you would love and I would love, and I would push you out of the way, of course, in getting them. But in many cases, many of the works that you would find would be things that would be meaningful to you. You know, taste is a funny thing. One of the things you also have to understand about collecting anonymous photography is that it's like going into a wine shop where all the bottles have no labels. There are tastings where you can taste the wine, but there's no labels. There's no Harlins, and there's no Clos de Vaux to tell you it's and the price tags are high, so they must be good, and all that sort of thing. There's a sense where you're really on your own out there, and whether the works are good or are not based on price tag or reputation, but based on your eye. And you know, to a certain extent, there are areas in art that are like this. Certain medieval art, there's no names. Indian art, Indian miniatures, the vast majority have no names. African art, the vast majority have no names. It's the thing itself that you have to judge. And it takes a lot of looking and a lot of certain amount of mistakes to get to that point. But the only way to do it is to try. The only way to do it is to start. And the great news is that the cost involved is not an important factor. As I say, about collecting in this area of anonymous photography, and then we're not necessarily snapshots. Anonymous photography are photographs of whom we do not know the maker. It could be a photograph that is clearly done by a professional photographer, a beautiful fashion photograph or something. There's some this evening that we'll see. But we just don't know who did the photograph. Vernacular is a word that people use in regards to photography. By anonymous photographs or photographs that were not made with an artistic intent. In other words, let's say there were some beautiful photographs taken of the building of a Chicago elevated, and they're really beautiful photographs, but they were only done to document building the subway or whatever, or the elevated. Well, those would be considered vernacular photographs. They might be done by some photographic firm in Chicago. They're not, you know, Alfred Stieglitz or Paul Strand. So those would be vernacular. So sometimes you have vernacular photographs that are known or unknown. What I'm especially interested in, photographs that are orphans, photographs that have no name. The photographs we're going to see this evening are parallel the chapters in my book, The Face and the Lens, that came out, the University of California Press published it in the spring of last year. And I don't know why, but I when I came up with the chapters, it came out with 10 chapters, all of which end in the letter Y. Immaturity, femininity, masculinity, compatibility, celebrity, adversity, activity, festivity, singularity. I wanted abnormality, but they said that's not a PC word anymore. So singularity is the word that they came up with. So, and then lastly, for old age and death, inevitability. So those are the chapters, and that's what you'll be seeing here this evening. In certain parts of the world, this would be considered a terrific likeness of somebody's wife, I guess. I just love the idea of a portrait that's not a portrait, or the portrait is more of a public building or something, as you see here. It's an amazing photograph, and the nature of when is a portrait a portrait? And so that's how I started. Again, it's North African around 1870. I've got 60 works to go through, so I've got to go rather rapidly, but it should be an interesting ride. This is a photograph, again, anonymous. I won't keep saying they're anonymous because they all are. When I looked at this, when I saw this, I immediately said, this could very well be, I'm not sure, but it could very well be, it's good enough to be a Helen Levitt. Helen Levitt was a marvelous street photographer of New York who passed away just last year in her mid-90s, I think. It's not a Helen Levitt, but it's as good as a Helen Levitt. And that's one of the things you find in photography, of this sort of photography. You find photographs that that were not done with the intention of looking like a famous photographer, but the work of art has the spirit of that photographer just because the camera and the moment that was captured locks in that moment that has parallels to some known photographer, in this case, Helen Levitt. Okay, let's see who knows their show business. Anybody know who that is? What? No. You got to go earlier. What? No. No, a dancer. No. This is Howard Nichols. He's one of the Nichols brothers. There were these movies in the 30s where, you know, there was some detective novel, detective story, and like in the middle of this thing, they had some nightclub scene, and these, I think there were four young African-American young men would come out. They were all about the age of Michael Jackson when he was a kid, and they'd dance up the storm and do splits and hops and everything, and the leader of this little group was about 12 years old, and so this is a photograph I found of Howard Nichols. Again, don't know who did it. And I show it because it is everything this photograph isn't. This boy is innocent. This boy is like a little waif on the street, and this little boy, I don't know whether it's good or bad, is like a young adult at age 10. He's been dragged into show business, and we know what happens sometimes when these kids are dragged into show business. I think in terms of Howard Nichols, he had a fairly stable life. This is the little boy. The Scottish novelist Alexander McCall Smith went out of his way to point out this photograph. He said that this is a photograph of a little boy who's been dressed by his mother in a kind of a little dress, and at the last moment, Dad thrust a gun in his arms to macho him up a little bit. It's a fantastic photograph. It's around 1880. You know, when you find a photograph like this, this brings up another interesting point. If there were a photograph by somebody like Richard Avedon, and there was a photograph of Charlie Chaplin, and you saw it in a show at SF MoMA, you could go to a gallery like the Franco Gallery and say, do you have a copy of that Richard Avedon? I'd love to buy it, you know, if I can afford it. And they'd say, well, maybe we don't have one, but we'll look for it. We might be able to get one for you. And there's a chance they might be able to get one for you. But if somebody came to me and said, Robert, I really love that photograph of the little boy with a gun. I know you don't want to sell it. You're keeping it. If you ever find another vintage print of it, let me know about it. I'd say, you know, keep your money, whatever. I'm never going to find another one. I mean, it's not going to happen. It's just, you know, it's just not going to happen. These works, that's one of the things that's tricky when you're out in the flea market, because when you see something like this, if you hesitate, first of all, if you put it down, somebody else can pick it up. But the second thing is, you know, if you put it down, it's not going to be there next month, the person's not going to be there, whatever. And you only have one shot, whereas when things are at a gallery, you can put it on hold, you can think about it, you can come back again. And in the case of, art photographs or prints and stuff that are printed in multiple editions, you can, even if one is sold, you can sometimes find another one. But in the case of these anonymous photographs, they're basically the only one. This is the fallacy. People say, oh, it's got a negative. It can be printed many, 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 many times. Well, obviously, this family only printed maybe one or two of the little boy with his gun, you know? And so, you have one swing at the bat. You don't have more. Can you imagine I got this photograph of Mr. Madoff at a young age? It's amazing. He obviously just stole his first piggy bank, I think, or whatever. Did his piggy bank futures or something? How could you pass a photograph like this of this little boy that is four or 5 years old and is dressed like he's 40? It's again parents projecting things on their children. Usually in a negative way, because the kids are very confused because they're kids and they don't know what the hell it's all about. This photograph, it's interesting how photographs have connections. This is not Brett Favre, I can assure you. This little boy in a football outfit, he is the saddest human being on the face of the earth at the moment this photograph was taken. And when I saw this photograph and acquired this photograph, I think it was done around 1948, I think, or so, but it had a date on the back, obviously no more information. When I got this photograph, the photograph that it triggered in my head was the famous photograph by Deanne Arbus of the little boy with a hand grenade in Central Park, who's kind of grimacing at Arbus. Now, that photograph shows kind of pent-up manic frustration on the part of the little boy with the hand grenade. This photograph has the same intensity, but it's an introverted intensity, the intensity that he wants to be anywhere on the face of the earth except for in a football outfit. And it's really sad. And, of course, in a way, this photograph is not of the little boy. This is a photograph of the father. You just have to assume it's a photograph of the father. And that brings up an interesting point. These photographs are not so much individual photographs as they are almost the illustration to a short story that hasn't yet been written. Because we do not know who the little boy was, we don't know the father, we don't know any of the circumstance of it, the work is the beginning. It's like the first paragraph of a short story visually that then you could write the rest of. Because these photographs, because they do not tell a particular history, we don't know the history, they are so wonderful in terms of triggering aspects of imagination that I've just told you my imagination about this photograph. You might have other ones. This is a photograph I got rather recently. It's about, 4x6. This is one of those photographs that if I were a contemporary photographer, I'd be pleased to have this photograph be 30x40. Because I think it's just a fabulous color photograph. Now, this little girl is probably about 40 years old now, wherever she is. But I love it. I don't know why I love it, but I do. I find it strange and mysterious and sad. The fact that it was not thrown away, obviously when it was taken, I'm sure it was thought to be a mistake. She blinked, you know. She had her eyes closed. But that's what makes it magic. And the nature of what art is about is subjective, and that's one of the reasons why I've loved my life and my career in the arts, because art is subjective. It's not this objectivity. But one of the things that one does, at least I do as a curator and a teacher, is Degas said an artist doesn't draw what he sees, but what he must make others see. And one of the things I try to do with photographs like these that I'm showing you this evening is just point out kind of the beauty, the mystery, the strangeness that's all around us that can be very easily overlooked. This is more typical. I mean, this could be on this would be a beautiful note card. This could be the cover of a children's book, etc. It is an accidental photograph. It's a snapshot, but it is just so kind of perfect in its simple beauty, which I love. But it's this one's easy to love. The next one is a little harder to love, also having to do with Halloween and masks. And this is a Polaroid, and this is tougher. I mean, the little girl doesn't, you know, she looks like she can't wait till Halloween is over. You know, she's not a particularly happy camper there. Maybe it's the flash or something. And obviously, one of the things that when you start collecting these things, you start to get very good at knowing within five or six years when these photographs were taken. So this photograph is probably about 1970 from the type of Polaroid film that was used and stuff like that. But as much as I like the previous one that's so lovely, which is kind of smooth and almost looks like it was done, you know, under art direction for an article in a magazine, and could very well have been, this photograph here has a kind of a roughness about it that I also find compelling. No, it's not a Dionne Arbus, but I'm sure she would have loved to have been able to credit this as hers. It is amazing. The man's shiny pants is just, it's heartbreaking, this photograph. It's just heartbreaking. This is in the face and the lens. I mean, I guess he's having a good time. I just don't know. I don't know who his tailor is, but his tailor obviously has a strange idea of mixing and matching clothes. Again, one of the things, you know, we laugh about it, and I laugh about it too, but there's a heartbreaking honesty about this photograph. One of the things about these anonymous photographs that I find is because they're not taken, most of them are not taken by professional photographers, there's an honesty with a capital H associated with these. And in that, we can laugh at it, and I can laugh at it too. But there's also a kind of sad respectfulness that we also have to think about them, because, life is hard, and then we die. And these photographs, you know, capture these moments, and there's a poignancy about it, because you know we laugh in the recognition, in a funny way, that we've all been there ourselves. We've all had slightly the wrong clothes at a party or something like that, or everybody knows everybody, but you don't. We don't know very many people at that party and stuff, and so we feel very, very ostracized. And so there's the laughter that I have, at least, is both at it, but also a certain self-recognition too. I love this photograph. It was a little snapshot, and I have this as the frontispiece to the section on femininity, because it's such a girly gesture, and I say that with all due respect to women, but it is such a kind of a wonderful kind of girly gesture. It's really quite special, and I love the spontaneity of it. I love the fact that clearly, you know, the camera was really close to the hand, and you know, the fact that the photograph came out at all, it was lucky, because this was taken probably in the 1920s. I take you through a few photographs. Is it a portrait or is it not a portrait? Is it a kind of a cheesecake photograph or is not? You know, it's a French photograph, but then again, you knew that already. Of this semi-nude woman taking off her blouse. But what I love about it, and what you'll see in the next couple of photographs, is the one you just saw before, is the sense of the choreography of gesture. The gesture of that woman's hand, the gesture of this woman taking off her blouse, and we can just see a bit of her face, so we do have a sense of her personality. The gesture here where the woman is, I guess, taking off her bra or fixing her bra or whatever, I find it kind of an amazing photograph. And again, one of the things you have to do with photography is you've got to slow down and kind of look in this particular case at that kind of hideous wallpaper in the background. You know, all of those things add to that particular moment. And this one here, you just know, I mean, if she's probably, I think she's Spanish. She might be Italian, but I think she's Spanish. And she's obviously bored. And it is, again, a wonderful sense of the gesture. It's not just, she's not just smiling. She's got obviously tons and tons of attitude. this is one of my favorite photographs in the book, and Alexander McCall Smith, the Scottish novelist that wrote the introduction to my latest book, he talks about this photograph being taken by Edward Hopper. Can you believe? You know, he's making it up, of course, but it has a Hopper-like quality, that sense of isolation, that sense of a kind of an alienation, the wary alienation. It's funny for me, when I first saw this photograph and got it, and again, I get so happy when I find a photograph like this, because it usually costs nothing, and it's just, I notice it. The person I bought it from has noticed it enough to get it, but usually they don't care too much. And when I saw this photograph, I could think of nothing other than that movie from the 40s by Noel Coward, Brief Encounter. You know, it has that quality about it. The light, it's to my mind, it's a perfect photograph. And, you know, if this photograph were known to be by Cartier-Bresson or something like that, it would be considered a great photograph. But it isn't. So what does that make it? If it's a great photograph but not by a great maker, does that mean it's not a great photograph? And to my mind, it's a great photograph. This is clearly a mistake. It is a mistake. It's inadvertent surrealism. When I did my first book, I wanted the title of my book to be Accidental Art, and they preferred it to be just the single word Anonymous, which I think is great, and I've got no problem with it in retrospect. But I stuck with the word Accidental Art, which is the title of my essay in the first book. And what you're looking at here is accidental art. This was not meant to be done. This was something that the camera moved and the person took the photograph and somehow got this wonderful double exposure. And one of the things I was mentioning to some people before the talk was that what happened in the past is what people would take 30, 40 photographs and they would... get them back from the processor. A photograph like this, they'd say, "Oh God, we made a mistake. You know, the camera moved," and they throw it in a drawer. They wouldn't throw it away, but they throw it in a drawer. They consider it a mistake. Of course, I would look through their photographs 40 years later when somebody didn't care about them and put them into an estate sale or something. And in fact, the only photograph that was worthy was this beautiful, crazy, surrealist mistake. The trouble is today, where people have their digital photographs, digital cameras, is that when something like this would happen in a digital photograph today, the people who would not have the taste to understand that it was really magic will delete it. And so in the future, these kind of accidental mistakes that are actually sometimes the most beautiful photographs probably will not occur very often because people will know better. They say, "Well, I'm just taking a picture of, you know, Cousin Sally," and that sense of the double exposure or something, some special angle, a special light, will be considered, quote, bad because the person will not understand. They won't have an aesthetic taste. And so those photographs will hit the delete button, and they won't survive the way these, quote, mistakes have survived over the years that I've been able to discover. This is just simply this marvelously attractive young French woman. And I would love to know why she has this gray wig on. You know, she's obviously, you know, 20 years old and she has a head like grandma, a wig of grandma on. It's I don't know whether it's weird or kinky, but it's a beautiful, beautiful photograph. And it mimics a famous photograph by Nadar. I don't think it's inadvertent, but it mimics a photograph by Nadar of the writer George Sand. Here's an example of what I consider an anonymous photograph by a professional photographer. It's clear that this is a carefully composed, beautifully retouched, airbrushed, negative, whatever. So this is clearly a professional photograph. But we don't know who did it. It's kind of semi-fashion, semi-erotic, probably from the 1930s, probably European. Some of those questions can't be answered. But it's beautiful, and because it's anonymous, it qualifies for my book. It is obviously not just a snapshot. It's an 8x10 photograph, but gorgeous and worthy of inclusion in the volume. photographs also come in very often in their original packaging. This photograph in this slightly hideously brown folder is the way it was presented, or whether it was sent from the photographer to the fireman who ordered it, or his family ordered it, and he is obviously very proud that he chops holes in buildings to get people out. And he's posed with his axe, probably from around 1920, and the photograph is slightly bizarrely hand-colored, except for himself. Hey, everybody has to have a living. And this man puts pins in himself. Now, if you cover up the man from the neck up, he looks like a bank teller. If you look at the rest of him, you realize that that he's got a different profession, although they have certain similarities considering the economy these days. This is, again, a European photograph. I do not know who took it. The thing that I was drawn to it was the placid nature of his face, the fact that he's totally relaxed with all of these hideous large pins sticking through his flesh. And if he is grimacing or making faces, it wouldn't be interesting. But the way it is, it's a special photograph. In this particular case, the war is over and the posing begins. Here we have a picture of an Indian who probably is a young man, maybe was fighting United States Army, the cavalry and stuff. But this is years later, and he really is an Indian. You look at that face and the hair and stuff. And here he's posing in a photographer's studio. And what I like about this is that this is probably like a preliminary photograph before they got in for a closer close-up, because you can see it's not a carefully posed against the backdrop photograph. So it's almost like an early test photograph. But it just goes to show, you have these Indians that one time were roaming the range with hundreds of thousands of buffalo, and now that he's in his late middle age, he's ending up being a prop in a studio. It's kind of sad. This is an example. These 12 photographs, this is kind of an early example of what would later be the so-called photo booth of photos. This is pre-photo booth, and so instead of having just 4 photographs or 6 photographs, here we have 12 photographs. And you see these from time to time. This one particularly appealed to me because the guy really got into it. He was having a great time. I especially love the one in the lower row where he's actually pulled his hat over his head, so you can't even really see his face. But he was having a great time, and I have a photo booth photograph in my first book, Anonymous, of this woman wearing sunglasses in the photo booth. And she has this rather sickly smile in the first photograph. And if you look very, very carefully, I think in the third photograph, she moves infinitesimally. But otherwise, she keeps the same pose and the same smile for all 4 photographs. In other words, she didn't get it. She didn't understand what a photo booth was about. Whereas this guy obviously was having a great, great time. Anybody recognize anybody in that photograph? I mean, not yourself or anything, but I mean, anybody recognize the photograph? Well, the man on the far right is Enrico Banducci, who ran, the Purple Onion and Enrico's on Broadway for many, many decades. And this is a photograph done around 1960. And yes, those are 3 men. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are 3 men. Yeah, pretty guy, I guess so. I think the guy on the left likes her. Look at her. I love all the beer cans. I love the beer cans lined up. It's fabulous. And also the dark and the light, because Enrico's all in black and stuff. Anyway, those are 3 guys. It's in the masculinity section, though. This is also in the masculinity section. And this, in fact, again, one of the things that's interesting, when the book goes out into the world, I get some information back. And an art historian in an art historian in Barcelona, who is the world's leading expert in Dora Maar. She pointed out to me that, in point of fact, that she didn't obviously know who took the photograph, but she said that the person who is in the photograph was an important European pop artist of the 1960s and early 70s named Eero, who was from Iceland. And that means now with Björk, there's two people from Iceland that I know of. But it was a rather good looking guy who was, and she said, that's Eero. And she had some book on him because she knew him. And in fact, it is Eero. So if I'd known that earlier, I would have gone into the small celebrity section of the book. But I love it. And I love the fact that, you know, he's put his head through this thing with the Superman, but you can see a little bit of the landscape to the left, you see? One of the things that there was a whole show at the Metropolitan Museum about two and a half, three years ago on spirit photography. And anybody that's been down to Stanford University knows that Mrs. Stanford was terribly into spiritualism after Leland Jr. died. And spiritualism was rampant in the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And considering the way our politics are, it probably will be coming back again soon. Here we have a photograph probably from around 1890. And obviously what they did, the photographer did, was to superimpose various negatives to make a hole and create this illusion. So this is probably around 1890. And this one here, which I like a lot, because the guy doesn't look like he's would be sitting in a spiritual photo, spiritualist photograph. This is from around 1920. But, you know, you see these things, and you can't make these photographs up. You know what I mean? And these photographs are not, this was not made to make art. This was made to capture some aspect of this individual's spirituality. So, there, again, just like the boy in the hideous shiny pants, one has to give a certain respect to a photograph like this because it wasn't taken to be cute or to be outrageous. It was taken with a lot of a kind of honesty about it. This is a small little snapshot. I love it because this is in our this is in the compatibility section of the book. And I just love that ever so slightly that boy is leaning away and the girl is coming forward. There's a marvelous, just ever so slight body language to this little snapshot that's just exquisite. And that's one of the key photographs in the compatibility section of the book. Anybody seen the program The Office? Well, you know, this has it's kind of I the thing that makes this little snapshot perfect of this woman sitting on this man's lap and taking dictation is that she's not smiling and he's not smiling. And if anyone was smiling, if it was a jokey photograph, it would be like a souffle that had dropped. The fact that they have this deadpan seriousness to it in the pose makes it just fantastic. And I would just love to know the story behind it. This was one of these time-released photographs. When I bought it because I love the photograph, and I didn't spend too much time looking at it until later. And then when I turned it over, I said, oh, my God. I said, this is really interesting. You know why it's so interesting? The, quote, man holding the cigar in the suit with a hat turned toward his beloved, he is a she. I know that because there was an inscription on the back of the photograph giving the two girls' names. And so, you know, when you start doing your Inspector Clouseau on the photograph, you'll notice that the man, quote unquote, in the suit, it's a very, very baggy suit. And obviously she slipped this thing on. She's holding a cigar. She's turned her hat so you can't see her face. And so they're obviously, these two girls are having a wonderful time. Is it an example of an early lesbian photograph? Well, maybe. Maybe yes. Maybe they're just fooling around. Who knows? But it's one of those photographs that the information on the photograph in of itself would not have been enough for me to discern that those were two women. The information on the back, of course, closed the deal. Anybody know what happens when a heart is upside down? I don't know. I have a whole book on the secret language of flowers from the 19th century, and there were all different flowers that you would send to a girl, and each flower would tell the girl something, and people, educated people, would know all these what different flowers would mean. So I haven't done enough research on this to know whether they were whether they were joking around or not. But in point of fact, I find it very beautiful. I love the pink of the mount too. But whether there's a symbolic reason for the heart upside down, I don't know. Yeah, well, this is one of those photographs again that is so violent. It's a tintype. It's one of those early photographs from the 1860s, 70s that were printed on tin. They were unique photographs. And obviously, this couple, somebody has violently taken a pair of shears and cut this photograph violently in two. And if, in fact, the photograph had no information on it, one would wonder, one would ponder, one could, you know, write a novel based, you know, put this on the cover of the book as to what happened here. In point of fact, in this particular photograph, we know what happened because on the back of it, it was inscribed, this is a photograph of Ma before she married Pa, and she hated the photograph, and that's why she cut it in two. So obviously they liked each other enough to have the girl who wrote the inscription on the back, and so the photograph does have a history, which we know. We don't know anything more about this couple, but in point of fact, this kind of anger that's displayed here is not necessarily directed at Pa, but at the photograph itself. This brings up a very important point for all of us, including myself, and that is when you have photographs of family, friends, etc., you know, at the very least, write some post-it notes and put them on the back of who they are, because your kids and stuff later, you know, if you don't get around to it, all they will be is a bunch of strangers in a box. And if you want to pass that information on, you have a responsibility, just like this woman did 100 years ago, to write on the back of the photograph so that we know more about it. So, and that's what happened here. Yes, this is Eng and Cheng. Eng and Cheng, they were the original Siamese twins. This is a carte de visite. It's an uncredited carte de visite, so it's an anonymous photograph, but they were very, very famous. They performed or posed for Barnum, and I love the amazing fact that they were on the Confederate side during the Civil War, and they were married to sisters and had something like 21 or 22 children between them. I'll leave it at that for your imagination to figure out, you know, which was date night in Disneyland for one or the other. The tragedy, of course, was that one of them was an alcoholic and the other one was a teetotaler. And the one who was an alcoholic killed them both. Yep, eventually. Again, I show these in part because, you know, it's easier to make a kind of a spectacle of people if the people are not just giants or midgets or co-joined, but if they're really others, such as the Siamese twins, or in the case of these African women that, because of their tribe or their customs, have these kind of rings put around their necks and make their necks grow very, very large. And obviously this was not something that was proposed by some circus, but it was something that was part of the hierarchy and customs of a particular part of Africa or a society in Africa. But needless to say, it is kind of amazing to see such things happen. Of course, unlike the co-join, Eng and Cheng, that were born that way, these women were kind of forced into being the way they are. And on one level, it's kind of amazing to look at. On another, it's kind of horrific. Here's somebody who took her curiosity all the way to the bank, and that was Josephine Baker. Josephine Baker, earlier in her career, she was one of these African Americans that came to Paris, and through talent and through a certain amount of patience in working the crowd, so to speak, became one of the great celebrities in France in the 20th century. And here she's really goofing it up. I mean, she, in a way, she's kind of playing almost a minstrel show type game with these. Because she was a singer and a dancer, she wasn't a musician. I don't believe she's just playing around with some guy's clarinet. But she had tremendous energy, and you know, she eventually got to a point where instead of being dictated to in her career, she started dictating in return. So you know, she had to struggle at the beginning, and then she came out very much on top. And she helped the resistance during World War II in France, and she became a national hero at the end of her life in Europe. Here's another picture of somebody in Europe, and you all know who that is, of course, Edward G. Robinson. This is on one of the book stalls on the quay in Paris. It's a press photograph. Don't know who took it. And Robinson, I've always had great respect for Edward G. Robinson because he was clearly, along with my friend Vincent Price, two of the most astute and art-loving of all actors in American stage or film. He had a marvelous collection, and at one point he had a divorce and he had to sell a lot of the paintings, and he sold them to a dealer where he said, if I can raise enough money, I want to buy back the paintings within like a year, and I'll pay you back with interest, but you have to hold the paintings for a year, and if I can't come up with the money plus interest in a year, then you can sell them, but I'll sell them to you if I have that chance. And he was able to raise enough money to buy most of the paintings back because he loved the paintings so much. Here's a photograph, an uncredited press photograph of Buster Keaton in London. And I love it because of the where he's posing, which is the Sphinxes along the Thames, and also the angle. It's a marvelously dynamic angle. And the photographer obviously wasn't just stand there, Mr. Keaton, I'll take your photograph. He actually had some creative ideas, and I think he came up with an absolutely terrific photograph. And again, it's one of those ones that maybe there's another one out there somewhere, but I don't know where it is. This photograph got me an awful lot of good publicity when I was in London this May, because this was a photograph, you all know who that is? It's the Queen of England. It's during her Lolita phase, which lasted about 15 seconds. That sculpture is supposedly a bust of her at that moment. Look at the bust. She looks like 30 years old in that bust. I mean, what a lousy sculptor. But she's wonderful. I love her little knock knees and stuff. And the Daily Telegraph, you know, which is it's a little bit of a step up from the New York Post. They got really excited about it and went to the Buckingham Palace. And the Buckingham Palace knew who the sculptor was and when the sitting was for the sculpture. And they had another photograph from the sitting, but they did not have this photograph. So I got my nanosecond of fame in the English yellow journalism with this photograph. I love this photograph because this shows the real Walt Disney screaming at his employees. Walt Disney has that old, you know, that sweet Uncle Walt reputation. But in fact, nobody is successful as Walt Disney without kicking a lot of butt. And Disney was one tough businessman. And he was pretty tough with his staff, too, in terms of getting some of his animated films made and stuff like that. And there were strikes and there were a lot of layoffs and stuff like that. So he was a fairly acrimonious guy. I'm sure they don't tell that story down at the Disney Museum. And probably this photograph isn't on view either. But, you know, as I said, for somebody like him, one has to have a respect for him because he did have a vision. And he pulled that vision, made that vision a reality. The next photograph is the one photograph that I wanted in my latest book, and my English publisher wouldn't put it in because he was afraid we'd get sued by the estate of the person who the photograph was. And I said, oh, you're making too much of it. And they said no. And so I had this marvelous page spread. I had Arthur Miller on one page staring at the person on the other page, which was going to be Joe DiMaggio. The two husbands of Marilyn, two of Marilyn Monroe's husbands, and they just didn't want this on the page. And You know, the question is, you know, what's good for the goose should be good for the gander. Why is a naked female, you know, fair game in practically to sell Coca-Cola and cars, yet male frontal nudity is you know, well, I guess since the governor, since the new senator from Massachusetts has been elected, I guess maybe we're passing. Maybe that's the one good thing about him being elected senator. Although, as somebody said, because, you know, he posed full frontal nude for Playgirl or something. Cosmo? Yeah, what, 20 years ago or something. But can you imagine if Martha Coakley had posed for Playboy or something? Or whoever, you know. I mean, could a woman get elected senator after posing for Playboy or something? So it's the double standard is still in there. But clearly the nasty bits on men just have a real hard time getting into print. The funny thing about this photograph is that Joe DiMaggio, you can see he's got a kind of a suntan face. He's probably just hit the home run that's won the game, and he's taking a shower probably around 1940 after a Yankee game, and he's smiling at the camera. It's not a titillating photograph or a paparazzi photograph whatsoever. But it didn't make it into the book. And you know who we put into the book instead? We put a photograph of D.W. Griffith. Well, D.W. Griffith, of course, was a great film director, but he was, of course, inadvertently responsible for the revitalization of Ku Klux Klan through his making of the movie A Birth of a Nation. You know, that stirred up a lot of sentiment. But D.W. Griffith did have his pants on, and so it was all right to have it in the book. Margaret Thatcher, one of my less favorite people, and I think it's so wonderful because she's shaking hands with this woman and not even looking at her. There's a famous photograph of Richard Nixon going down a line, and he's shaking one person's hand and looking at his watch with the other, and it's just, you know, yes, she's such a sincere politician, isn't she here, you know? I really am interested in your hair curls. This is a photograph that's interesting. Who do you think this is a photograph of? What? Which Kennedy?
Robert.
Joe. This had after President Kennedy was assassinated, this photograph turned up. I found it in England, and it had a label on the back that said that it was a photograph of John Kennedy when he was over in England, but clearly it's Joe Kennedy, the eldest son of Ambassador Kennedy, who was killed in a plane crash during a secret plane crash in action during World War II. This is a photograph taken approximately 60 seconds before the President of the United States was assassinated in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And it is more than kind of any other photograph. This is the sort of photograph that reminds us all that a photograph is a moment of time captured. It captures that moment. It locks it in. As you can see on the faces of the governor and of Texas and his wife and John and Jackie Kennedy, they're enjoying the crowd. The crowd is enjoying them. It's a wonderful moment that's about to change forever. And photographs capture these little slices of time that we can never bring back. And there was a wonderful quote, one of my favorite books on photography, a very thoughtful book by the French philosopher Roland Barthes, a book called Camera Lucida. And he said in that book, he said, I look at a snapshot of my mother, and I look at her and I say, she's a pretty little girl, and she is dead. And because the photograph was taken, you know, decades before. And he said, whether they're meant to be or not, he said, every photograph is a catastrophe because it locks in something that can never come back again. As soon as the camera clicks, as soon as the digital camera locks in that slice of time, everything goes forward and nothing stays the same again. Sometimes things get better, and in the case that we see here, sometimes things get worse. Sorry to be maudlin. Here's another photograph. This is a photograph I bought of Bobby Kennedy the day he was shot in Los Angeles on the last day of the California primary in 1968. It's a marvelous photograph, the angle with the palm trees, the assistant holding him so he can shake the hands in the crowd, because if he didn't have that assistant, he would just have been pulled in there. As some of you know, he rolled up his sleeves so he didn't lose. He had to go through tens of cufflinks because people would steal his cufflinks as souvenirs and stuff. So it was easier just to roll up his sleeves. It made him look more macho, but it was also, the cufflink bill was getting crazy. It's a marvelous image, and it's one of those things where it captures a moment of triumph, just like the one previously of his brother, and it reminds us or it makes us frustrated with what could have been. We all know who this is, and sometimes you see a photograph of somebody and you say, oh. You know, that mild-mannered person, kind of Ted Bundy, he doesn't look like he could do that, such horrible things to people. But when you look at this particular photograph of Charles Manson, it's a rather famous press photograph. Again, I don't know who took it. It's amazing because it captures the kind of rowdiness of the Manson trials and all that, but it also captures somebody that if he could get you alone or me alone, he would want to kill us, There's a sense that this man... This is a photograph of evil. This is a photograph of pure, unadulterated evil. This is a trick photograph. A trick photograph in the sense, when I say trick, in that this gentleman is not about to be executed. He's obviously got his Van Heusen shirt on and his tie. And so he's obviously posing. He's probably from the electric chair company, and he's just installed this thing, and they're making sure that it's all that all the straps fit and all that stuff. But clearly, people did not go to the electric chair wearing a business suit and tie and shiny brown shoes like that. So on one level, it's on first glance horrific, but on second glance, it's not in fact what you think it is. This is one where you look at the face and you make sure you never have her come to clean your house. Her name is Antoinette Cesari, and she's the poisoner of Saint-Gilles, condemned to death on the 28th of April, 1926. This is a press photograph. This is a photograph that was taken of this woman, and they inscribed it. And in fact, the photograph is heavily touched up. You can see the white and the black ink on it. So it's a touched up photograph. It's a press photograph as opposed to a mugshot. I'd like to believe, even if I didn't read the caption down below, that I wouldn't let her in the house. Or this guy. This is Scarface. Yes, it is. It's Al Capone, who used to live here out on Alcatraz. He used to be a resident of the city, so to speak. And I did use a wonderful quote of his in the book. He once said, "You can go farther in life with a kind word and a gun than just a kind word." My books just don't deal with pretty happy images. They're not, kind of gifty books. I try to have them be thoughtful. This is a photograph, obviously, of a Ku Klux Klan member. But what I find about it is that makes this photograph is not the fact that he's wearing his Ku Klux Klan outfit, but the three things: the wallpaper, hideous. The radiator, and then the shaft of sunlight hitting the room. So this is a photograph that he's proud to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but how will his neighbors know who he is? So on one level, it's like that first photograph we saw of the woman in North Africa. He's posing in a way that nobody will ever know who he is. Strange. Adversity. Here's this little boy posed on a couch with his little leg, in a complete cast. He doesn't know what hit him, so to speak. He's obviously broken his leg, and for whatever reason, Ma or Pa wants to take a photograph of him. That sense of helplessness is really poignant in this little photograph. Here's another photograph that's very sweet and sad at the same time. This is a young girl who's been photographed probably for medical reasons, and I don't think she was burned. I think this is some sort of a very large birthmark, some sort of skin disease or something. And she's very sweet, and she's stuck with this. This is probably from the 1920s or teens, and so I'm not sure whether something like this could have been treated at that time. I'm sure something like that today could be dealt with quite easily, but maybe not then. Here's another marvelous photograph. I should have a photograph of all people wearing masks or something at some point. This, of course, he's wearing his mask because it's probably 1918, and it's that terrible influenza epidemic that killed hundreds of thousands of Americans, which was just devastating. In fact, my father was struck by the influenza, but he recovered. It was a very, very terrifying time, and it's amazing how few books, how many, I don't know of any movies and stuff about it. People kind of don't like to remember how bad it was. It's kind of like you don't want to stir up such bad memories. But I think more people were killed, more Americans were killed in the influenza epidemic than American soldiers were killed in all the wars from the Revolutionary War till now combined in that 1.5 years from 1918 through 1919. So, it was really quite devastating. But it wasn't just confined to the United States, but it was really quite terrible. But, you know, this guy's posing, but he ain't going to get the germs of the photographer, so he's got his mask on. And here's a photograph from about the same time, and this is one of these trick photographs where he's given a photograph of his son or daughter to the photographer, and they have been able to make it into this trick photograph where the smoke from his cigarette wafts up and turns into the memory of his child while he's away fighting in France. I don't know what's going on in this photograph, okay? It is very, very weird why this smiling woman's face appears on a wave breaking over a jetty. I don't know. Again, somebody had an idea about this photograph, and it is completely zany. And when I saw it, I was very happy, but I also felt, what is going on here? Do you think she died? Do you think this is like a memory? I don't know. I don't know whether it's a memorial photograph or not, but it is truly weird. And then finally, in closing, you've got these photographs of old age, and I love some of these because there's a wonderful respect to it. Here, I think this is a Spanish photograph of this woman on a balcony sewing. Here, I think it's Russian, but it could be German or Northern European, of this guy with this marvelous mustache. And there's a wonderful sense, he's not looking at the camera, there's a wonderful sense in his gesture and the way he's sitting of a thoughtful introspection. This photograph, what's going on here? Here it's a double exposure of this man's face floating in this building. Maybe he was the architect who died and some photographer had superimposed his structure with his portrait. I don't know the story. We don't know anything about it, so it's left to conjecture. This one here I love because she's 103 years old and it was taken at the end of the 19th century, and she was around when Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI were still on the throne of France. I mean, talk about time travel. And, of course, in those days, 103, 103 was quite extraordinary. Today, it's less extraordinary in America and in Japan. So many people are over 100 now that when you're over 100 in Japan, the government sends you some little silver cup, and they've had to make the cup smaller because so many people are living to be over 100 that, I don't know, there's something like 60 or 80,000 people in Japan. They're over 100 years old. I mean, anyway, so this is, again, it's an extraordinary kind of photo of time travel here of a woman who was around, in the 18th century. And here, this photograph reminds me of the last scene in the movie The Shining. Have you all seen the movie The Shining? It's kind of an extraordinary movie. And at the very end of the movie, after all sorts of mayhem occurs and Jack Nicholson is gone, dead, the camera at the very end of the movie starts from one end of this room and gets closer and closer and closer and closer to a photograph from the turn of the century. And as it gets closer, it goes into this big party, and then it gets closer into a table, and then it goes up to a single person in this photograph wearing a 1920s tuxedo. And, of course, it's the Jack Nicholson character. There's Jack Nicholson in a photograph from 80 years before. It's very effing weird. And what you see here is me in 1910 surrounded by bathing beauties. This is not Photoshopped. I found this photograph that kind of looks like me. I don't know if it completely looks at me, but it kind of looks like me from around 1910. It's very strange. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you look at enough photographs, you'll find yourself in them, you know. My mother passed away in the spring of 2007, and after she passed away, she loved my first book, Anonymous. She didn't live to see this one, but my brother sent me some photographs, including this one, an uncredited photograph, so it's truly anonymous. And in point of fact, I put it in the book. My mother is the little girl in 1917, 2 years old, leaning on the front. She's the littlest there. She's leaning on the front of this little car. And the older girl and the two boys are my aunts and uncles. They're all gone now. But I know everything about them. I know who their children were. I know what they did in life. I know their tragedies. I know their triumphs. I know everything about all of them. And every photograph in my book, every photograph we saw this evening, has that same sense of history as long as somebody knows and cares. But unfortunately, with the majority of the photographs that we've seen tonight, except for a few of the celebrities, the umbilical cord of knowledge to the work has been cut, has been lost. And so the photographs become for what they are. They have to live on their own. And whatever we think about them is pure conjecture. And then finally, the photograph you see here brings up a quote that I will close with of Deanne Arbus, who said about photography, "They are proof that something was there and no longer is, like a stain, and the stillness of them is boggling." The sense that that these photographs, we think of photographs as information. They give us knowledge. They give us information. But in the case of a lot of the photographs I've shown you tonight, they raise more questions than they answer. And they allow us to dream, as I have done, after acquiring these things and sharing them with you. Thank you so much.
We can give a few moments for question and answers if you'd like. Just maybe three questions. So I'll pass this around.
My question was the celebrities that you have.
Yes.
Were those found randomly, or did people send those to you, or did you request them? How did you get most of those?
Well, the photograph of Al Capone, he graciously posed for the state of Illinois for that mugshot. So that was in fact a posed photograph. But a lot of the other ones, I occasionally stumble across photographs of these so-called celebrities. In my book, the photograph of Joe DiMaggio taking the shower, that was probably a press photograph. But many of the other ones, you know, celebrities also have snapshots taken of them too, and those are the ones that are really interesting, because the ones that where they pose very carefully for a professional photographer, they're wearing their mask, and the ones that I've tried to find for my book are photographs where they kind of get caught unawares, or if not unawares, you get caught in a kind of a candid sensibility. There's a fabulous story of Richard Avedon, who once was going to photograph the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and you couldn't have two more brittle human beings walking the earth than them. And they had been photographed hundreds and thousands of times, and they had their game face. They knew exactly how to pose and how to smile, you know, just like actors and actresses on the so-called, when they're going into the Academy Awards and stuff. And so when Avedon set up his camera, he had it all set to go, and then he lied to them. He said, "I'm so sorry, you know, your majesties," or whatever you're supposed to call them. He said, "I'm sorry I was a few minutes late today, but on my way here, my taxi ran over a dog on the way." And he knew that they liked dogs more than they liked people. And when they heard that the dog had been run over, their faces dropped and he clicked the camera and he got them. So sometimes you have to be clever to get people who are so used to having their photographs taken that they, you know, they only pose from the right or the left or something like that. So those kind of candid photographs are the ones that are really magic when you can find them, which is not very often.
Do you have to get releases for those?
No, because they're anonymous. No. If you take a photo, if George Clooney were walking down Market Street and you had a camera, you could take a photograph of him, and you're not you don't have to get a release from George Clooney on the street. But if you take a posed photograph or in somebody's house or something like that, then you have to. But street photography, it's you don't have to get a release in that case. No, I think there's an equal amount of ineptitude on the part of the average photographer, both nations. What you occasionally will find, and it's like hitting a vein of gold, is where you have some amateur photographer who just has a wonderful touch. They're not a professional photographer, but they just take really good photographs over and over and over again. Maybe you have somebody, in your family has that same quality. And those are wonderful because, you know,